If there was already a crisis simmering in Venezuela, in the past month, it's boiled over. An international tug of war is playing out as countries choose whether to recognize Juan Guaido or Nicolás Maduro as the country's constitutional leader. And some countries are trying to stay out of the fray altogether. Meanwhile, Venezuelans are focused on daily survival. This is Karin Zissis of ASCOA Online. In this episode, my colleague Holly Sunnelin sits down with Guillermo Zubillaga, who heads the ASCOA Venezuela Working Group. They talk about what kind of calculus the Chinese might be thinking through, the generosity of countries like Colombia and Canada, and how millions of Venezuelans just want the misery to end.
You're listening to Latin America in Focus.
Latinoamérica en foco.
América Latina en foco.
A podcast by America Society, Council of the Americas, on politics, economics, and culture in the region.
I'm here this morning with Guillermo Zubillaga, who is head of the ASCOA Venezuela Working Group. Guillermo, thank you so much for being with us here today.
My pleasure.
So Venezuela has not been in the news at all this last week.
Not at all.
How are you doing?
Great. I mean, trying to keep up with the news and not read any fake news, but it's really hard.
Yes, especially when most media in Venezuela
yes.
is shut down. So
yes.
adds a whole other layer to things.
And when WhatsApp is like the main vehicle for news. So yes, it mm-hmm. is hard, but.
And so, again, a lot of our listeners have fewer resources. So first of all, let's just catch people up on what basically has happened just in the last few weeks, because a lot of stuff has happened. So so Venezuela has obviously been following deeper and deeper into crisis over the last few years. And opposition leaders, with support from others, have decided that January 10th, which is the start of Maduro's second presidential term, would be the moment to really turn things around. And they're basing this off of Maduro's election to a second term was illegitimate by almost every count. Opposition members were barred. The Congress wasn't consulted on the dates. Their powers were taken away. And a host of other intimidation factors, extortion factors of voters led to this election being fraudulent. So on January 10th, when his second term started, the president of Congress, Juan Guaido, stood at a rally in Caracas and administered the oath of office to himself, which surrounded by a crowd of people also raising their right hands and taking an oath themselves, which might look incredible, but is actually a process prescribed in the Venezuelan Constitution. Article 233 says that the president of Congress takes over if and when the president is unavailable to serve. And also there are articles that specifically give the right to the people to take back their democracy if they feel that it is being taken away from them. So we saw this happen, and then we also saw just this past weekend on February 2nd, there were more marches in Caracas and in Maracaibo and in even tiny towns all over Venezuela. What was going on in those marches?
I think that was a historic moment in Venezuela. I think we've never seen such a mobilization, as you said, not only in Caracas, but all over the nation, in places that had been completely controlled by the Chavismo, not only by Maduro and Chavez party, but by the state. They were places that had complete and total control of the population through jobs, through intimidation, and people just came out in masses and peacefully. And I think that's something that was interesting beyond the amount of people and the geographic widespread of the protest was that no one was arrested or that usually happens in other protests. And I mean, to me, my reading is that the security forces of Maduro are increasingly isolated and it becomes increasingly unpopular to arrest. I think that that's telling, and I think also the images that we saw, despite the censorship, of people coming out, send a strong message to the international community that Maduro not only has lost his constitutional mandate, but he has also lost the popular mandate.
Mm-hmm. And we should add, too, that while February 2nd was largely peaceful, that does not mean that the security forces have been peaceful at all since mm-hmm. this has happened. Since January 22nd, they've been going on raids in poor neighborhoods. They even were giving a warning to poor neighborhoods on the day before Guaido took the oath of office. And then Reuters reports that, let's see, since January 22nd, The Venezuelan Observatory of Violence, which is a local crime monitoring group, attributes 43 deaths to security forces during protests and raids. And then also that authorities have arrested more than 900 protesters since January 21st. And this, of course, is on the backdrop of protests in 2017, which saw over 100 people killed and hundreds more arrested. So there has been, the marches this past weekend were a reassurance, but there has been a lot of tension too.
Absolutely, and I think that was what was different in the last marches, that we didn't see that level of, you know, intimidation and violence toward protesters. So, you know, a reader, an observer like me will be drawn to the conclusion that security forces are less and less willing to follow orders. That means being violent against an increasing portion of the population that probably includes, you know, their own family members and, you know, neighbors, etc. So,
yes, because, you know, while a lot of the generals are very inoculated, the lower ranks are right there with everybody else.
Yeah. And they're not escaping, you know, the general misery that is created by the hyperinflation and the shortages and the lack of any sort of public service.
What did you make of, on Monday night, Maduro made veiled threats to Juan Guaido, to his security. What did you make of those?
I mean, again, it's just more threats. I think that, you know, even though there are threats, they are unwilling or they don't take the final step of arresting him. Or, I mean, they did arrest him back in early January, but that was very short. So, again, I think that Guaido has now a level of freedom that no other opposition leader of his magnitude has had in the past. Whenever there was a leader of this level rising like this, the government quickly did something to arrest him or her or limit that leader's exposure and traveling. So it's really remarkable to see how they have kind of like realized that Guaido is some sort of, in a way, untouchable because of the international community pressure and, of course, of the popular support that he seems to be to have right now in this moment of transition.
And also at this moment that they have a lot, the Maduro regime has a lot more,
correct,
less credibility to arrest somebody because they know that they're under so much more pressure.
Indeed.
Not that they ever had credibility to arrest people, but
same
point. So let's also go then, because there have been a lot of developments with international recognition of Guaido as president. A bunch of European countries gave Maduro until the end of Sunday night to call for new elections. He did not do that. And so on Monday morning, I think it was about a dozen countries came out and said that they recognized Guaido as Venezuela's interim president. So what was your take on that?
My take, I mean, I think, first of all, I've always said that it's we should look at what the hemisphere says. I mean, what the hemisphere, you know, the position of the hemisphere on the region is. And that one is overwhelming of support towards a transition and following the constitutional rules. Yet I'm also shocked by the consensus that there seems to be in Europe. I know Italy was one of the big ones, but they have an internal political dynamics within their own governing parties. But I think that any person who saw what happened on Monday, the waterfall, the cascade of recognitions towards Guaido from Europe, I think that was a strong message because they're following the constitutional path. And they're recognizing President Guaido as the interim president. So it's very hard for me to see how Europe can back down from that position. And also to see countries like Spain, who in the past, I mean, Spain is one of the most important countries in Europe dealing with Venezuela because of trade ties, because of diaspora ties, because of, you know, many Chavista and Madurista leaders have park their money in Spain. So they do have a lot of leverage. I mean, of course, the United Kingdom, France, et cetera, do as well. But to see Spain so with so much conviction of what needs to happen, to me, was very shocking. Also, we shouldn't forget that, you know, Spain was the first official visitor. Prime Minister Sanchez was the first official visitor to Mexico. So, I mean, they're not seen as a right-wing government in the region. He also went to Cuba recently. So I think that is a strong stand from Europe, and one that generals, top Maduro officials, etc., are definitely noticing.
I mean, it's hard not to at this point.
It's really hard not to, yes.
So, and like you mentioned too, I mean, Europe is responding. They're really following the leadership of the Lima Group, yes. Which is a group of 14 countries in the Americas. It is led by Peru. Also, Canada has shown a lot of leadership, Colombia. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Also this weekend, they had meetings in Ottawa. On Monday, Canadian Foreign Affairs Minister Chrystia Freeland, she made that point specifically that it actually is, in her reading of the situation, the constitutional weight is with Guaido, that it is actually harder to justify constitutionally still backing Maduro because his presidency is so illegitimate at this point, or it's completely illegitimate, I suppose there's not a scale. So, that was her plea to anybody else still considering, was that it's a harder to make a case to recognize Maduro right now than it is to look at the Constitution and realize that Guaido is the clear, legitimate, democratically elected leader.
Yeah, and I think these countries are following a path that started in May when they did not recognize the election that took place to, you know, elect Maduro.
Elections in air quotes.
Yeah, elections in air quotes. This is not something that they suddenly switched their stand or because there is massive. I mean, I think that has added to their conviction of the position that they're taking. But if you go back in May, these same countries were also not convinced by the results of the elections that, as you said in the beginning, were not observed, banned the biggest parties of the opposition and many other issues that, you know, we can talk about them. But I just, you know, I like to point that out, that there is some sort of continuation in the policy that they've been adopting with Venezuela. And this is what the constitution of Venezuela indicates to do. So I think there is consensus and there is a desire for following the constitutional rule. And I think that's pretty remarkable to see that.
Okay, so while we have had all this considerable recognition by different international countries, I think we're up to over 30 countries and bodies recognize Maduro, who are still the big holdouts?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't call China a holdout, but we have to remember China has been the biggest lender to the 20 years of Chavismo that we have seen, and they have, of course, very strong ties for many years.
I think China, have they lent Venezuela something in the realm of $40 billion?
$40 billion, yeah, or 50, or they owe 40. I mean, it's around that.
But it's not chump change.
It's not. Yeah. It's not. In fact, this is one of China's big. Venezuela is one of China's biggest recipients of you know, foreign loans and it's a very, of Chinese investment. So I don't think that China, being pragmatic and of being owed this much amount of money, is willing to bet that Maduro, under this context that he's in right now, will be the right person to pay them back the money that they're owed. There also, we know that there is a lot of opposition to the investment that were made in Venezuela and the return that they have, you know, the lack of return that they've created. And there's also the willingness of China to show the region that they can be a constructive partner and they're not going to be, you know, a hurdle in finding a sustainable solution for the people of Venezuela and for the region, because as we know, this is a crisis that has, you know, surpassed the borders of Venezuela into the neighboring countries, not only neighboring countries, but into many regional countries.
Mm-hmm. Russia also has lent a lot of money to Venezuela and
yes.
Have come out much more in support of Maduro, very fervent.
Yes, and then also, you know, I think that a lot of the support that Russia has given, it's through Rosneft. So it's been a financial relationship. I don't think that we can, I mean, of course it has enjoyed the support of both states and Russia's foreign policy, but it has primarily been a business first relationship. And I think that again, as in the case with China, and we've seen it since the US imposed the oil sanctions, Russian companies, Lukoil is not willing to jeopardize their relationship with the U.S. only on Venezuela. So I think that, you know, with these two superpowers, we may see some pragmatism because they're not, they're aware of the regional stand, they're aware of the many, many attempts that the Maduro administration has taken at trying to correct the economy, and they are aware that more than ever he is less unlikely to successfully turn the country around without having the support of the U.S., without having the support of Europe, and of course, without having the support of the majority of the population in Venezuela. So I think that those are the equations that they're just trying to figure out how can a transition be done peacefully.
Mm-hmm. So whose support, you think, if they came out in this next week in support of Guaido, whose support would be the most critical, or then the flip side, the most devastating for Maduro if he lost them?
I think the Chinese, I mean, I think also the Japanese have been a little bit unclear, but I mean, they both said that they're willing to work with all sectors of the, all sides, I guess, of the political sides. And I think, yeah, I think it would be interesting to see stronger messages from China. And I wouldn't be surprised, though, if we see them, because time is running out, money needs to be paid. You know, this is a crisis that is not, the inflation hasn't stopped. The oil production hasn't stopped decreasing. So time is of essence for many of the Venezuelan partners.
Mm-hmm. And I think, I mean, with that urgency, there's a sense of, even if things stay the status quo right now, that is an increasingly perilous situation for Venezuelans. The more things stay as they are, right? Because right now is the crisis.
Yes, yeah, exactly. I agree.
So, and in terms of then a timeline, I know that, so there are new U.S. sanctions that will severely restrict Venezuela's oil. And there are some reports that Venezuela only has about 7 more days.
Yes.
So what is your take on that?
Well, yeah, we have to remember that despite Venezuela being a producer of oil, Venezuela needs refining more lighter oil and refining products to refine their own oil in order to have gasoline and diesel. So the Venezuela's fuel supply is highly dependent on the products that it imports, mostly from the U.S. to refine its oil. So that is a situation that will worsen and that will escalate the crisis. Remember that distribution, I mean, this is the distribution that's needed for food. This is the, you know, like any economy, fuel is needed to keep whatever economic activity is happening. So we will see a faster and bigger contraction, and we will see probably larger shortages due to the fact that there won't be any fuel supply in addition to power shortages. So I think that has an impact very soon.
Do you think that this will be kind of the next critical point? Like, what happens if in a week Maduro is still in power and the oil runs out?
I think that would provide, I mean, more impetus or more traction to any sort of possible to Maduro and his team to really come to a table. I mean, I think that they're unwilling to come to a table because they know that what the other side will ask, and it's free and fair elections. And I don't think that it will be hard for them, having the support of the EU, of the region, for the opposition to suddenly back down from that ask. So, you know, Maduro is reluctant to come to the table. But if the situation continues to worsen, which I think will, I think that he's going to face a lot of internal pressure, especially from those that are keeping him in power, who are the generals. And
mm-hmm. And so on that issue of coming to the table, let's talk about dialogue, which can be a sort of exhausting topic for Venezuelans and people who have been following it. But because dialogue, in a general sense, in normal terms, that would be a preferable option. It's a good time to come, talk, try and resolve differences. Why is that such, I think at this point, a frustrating suggestion for
Venezuela? Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it's important to take every opportunity to explain why the opposition is reluctant to participate. Because back in 2017, right, they participated in a dialogue in the Dominican Republic, a dialogue that was, I guess, sponsored or overseen by the Vatican. It had some sort of the blessing of the U.S., of the EU. So it had really serious partners, involved Mexico. And yet the Maduro regime was able to fool everyone in a way that they seemed convinced, I mean, and willing to do the things. And then when it was time to implement whatever they had agreed on the table, they wouldn't do it. So
And I mean, a classic example is Maduro would say, the request from the opposition would be, we would like these political prisoners released. And
yes.
So Maduro regime would release some prisoners, and then they would turn around and arrest different people.
Right, the famous rotating door that, you know, mm-hmm. civil society people who work with political prisoners always tell you about. So
yeah, which would be a textbook case of how to enter into negotiations in bad faith.
Exactly. So that's why they have earned this reputation of not being trustable negotiators, and this is why it's not only the opposition, but it's also, again, the regional group, the Lima group, saying that we cannot participate in a fruitless dialogue. I think that it's clear that any sort of dialogue that happens that involves the opposition and its, international allies will have to start with the three, with Maduro exiting power in order for the transitional government to call for free and fair elections.
Yeah, because I mean, that's the basic assessment of that, of the dialogue. That dialogue at this point, I think the Lima group actually said attempts for dialogue have been manipulated by the Maduro regime. And so dialogue at this point, it's not a neutral territory. It's a situation that actually benefits the Maduro regime because it keeps them in power longer and it prolongs the crisis that the Venezuelan people are suffering right now. And there's no need for them anyway because everybody knows what we already need to do, which is hold elections.
Yes.
You mentioned Mexico having participated in the dialogue a couple years ago. And I think it's important to point out because when you look at the whole region, Mexico's absence feels notable, but they have a particular history that explains that. The context would be that Mexico, since the 1930s, has had this policy, the Estrada Doctrine, which is specifically a principle of non-interventionism, not having a willingness at all to interfere in other countries' affairs, and this principle of sovereignty. And that was the principle for decades for Mexico. And it was, in the previous administration, it was a new thing that they were involved in Venezuela. But since December 1st, there's a new administration, and they have since pulled back.
Yes.
And which is, again, partly it's in line with this history that they have, but then also at the same time, if you're a Venezuelan leader, this is clearly the moment of need, and to have someone who has been working with you then pull back.
Yeah, that exactly. I think that you just said that very well. And they switched their minds and they participated in that dialogue before the one in the Dominican Republic that I mentioned in 2017. So they were there and they witnessed how, you know, the Maduro regime wasn't willing to implement whatever was agreed upon on the table. I think Mexico is trying to stay flexible and, you know, outside of this. As you know, Maduro was invited to the inauguration of López Obrador in a moment where he was already isolated by the international community. But the reality is that I don't think that the opposition and the portion of the population that they represent will see as Mexico as a trustable negotiator.
So here we are in early February. Things are very much in flux, but basically, it seems like we have three possible options. And the first and the one that everybody is hoping for is that Maduro steps down on his own, that he recognizes he is completely backed into a corner, he has nowhere else to go, and he leaves. And then Guaido can fully step in with the backing of the military and hold these new elections.
Yes, that's the most, you know, desirable transition that I think everyone who's been following Venezuela would like to see. Some people find it unlikely. I don't, you know, I want to see what the conversations in Uruguay this week, as we know, the European Union is going to be in Uruguay in meetings that I believe the government is also going to be represented at, the Maduro government. So I think that with the consensus, again, that Europe showed yesterday supporting President Guaido, with the unity of the opposition, I think that that's a very strong negotiating point of departure for the opposition and its international allies. So we may be surprised on the ability for Maduro to understand that his future looks and that if he decides to stay in power, will increase the chances of violence. That may be a scenario that he wants, maybe to show that he's actually against what they would call an imperialistic oppression and intervention. But I doubt that the generals and senior officials of his cabinet and of Chavismo, because Chavismo, you know, still exists as a guiding force in Madurismo and in Venezuelan politics. I think that there will not be an appetite for that kind of confrontation from many people in Maduro's inner circle. So especially with the dire situation of the economy, and especially with the popular support that we have seen for a transition. So it would be a very unpopular, I guess, road of action. But, you know, this is what dictators have done in the past, and you know, it's definitely an option that we cannot rule out.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think it bears repeating too, like there's a, talking about, you know, will the military support Maduro or Guaido, the military has a very particular history in Venezuela with politics. Sometimes it has come on the side of the people and ousted a president, and sometimes it's gone the other way and it's supported a president and repressed the people.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that second option of the military, let's say, taking over the conduction of the transition and saying, okay, Maduro, you're out, but we're in charge of this. I think given the exposure that Venezuela has and needs in order to secure financing, to be able to provide basic services, and I'm talking about sales of oil to the U.S., I'm talking about a good relationship with China, I think that those were going to be leverage points that the international community is going to have on the military if they decide to own their transition. So the military may decide to own the transition, but they're not going to be willing to really take the country in an economic path when you have the region, when you have your biggest trading partners, and when you have China and Russia really wanting to be paid back their money that they have invested. So I can see that option, but I can see also how that option doesn't pan out in a way of really transforming the country into what people really want. They just want, you know, to be able to afford a certain basic goods, be able to eat three times a day, be able to, you know, save some money and not have to deal with this hyperinflation and have to migrate as we've seen in the past. So I can see that scenario, but I can also see how the scenario doesn't really hold on.
Yeah, because it'd be one thing if, you know, for Maduro to have this kind of cognitive dissonance and kind of denying what's happening. It'd be another thing for the entire military to kind of keep that up.
Yeah.
Because I think, you know, they want to get back to normal, too. And
yeah,
it can be very conflicting if you're a military person and you like order to not know who you're supposed to be following.
Right.
At a given time. So best case scenario is if Maduro steps down on his own. The second would be if the military has to step in and kind of institute a transition. And then the third scenario that everybody keeps talking about, well, I should say observers like to talk about, but the diplomats involved have been very, very reluctant, is obviously then foreign intervention.
I think any sort of foreign intervention will not, you know, I don't know who would be leading that foreign intervention. Of course, people point to the U.S. but I think that we have not really exhausted the diplomatic channels. I think that, you know, China and Russia, again, I mean, especially China doesn't want to be owed billions of dollars by a country now that is being intervened. So I think that China can pull the rug kind of from Maduro and the military because they have that ability, given the amount of money that they've invested and the ties that they have and their role in the oil sector. So I like to believe that before the intervention happens, there may be more diplomatic channels that can be used, especially having Europe, which has now, you know, many different types of governments and also the region. So, you know, there could be really, let's say, a broad table discussion to avoid that. Because it's not that you have, you know, right-wing governments against left-wing governments. As I said, you have Spain, you have Canada. So they can really be, I think that the world, because we're talking literally now about the world, can come together and avoid that intervention or aggression.
Mm-hmm.
That's my hope.
Yeah. I mean, and again, as a Venezuelan, what does it feel like for you? I mean, the countries like foreign intervention in Latin America doesn't have a good history, especially from the U.S. So, I mean, what's as a Venezuelan, what is that like for you to hear new talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I just want to know that, let people know that I'm not a Venezuelan living in Venezuela, but I do have a lot of family. I have a lot of contacts. I still am very connected, and people are not thinking about the history of U.S. intervention. People are not thinking about what many of us are thinking. They are thinking, how can we go back to normal? I can only afford barely, you know, two eggs, or if so, I cannot afford my kids' school, I cannot afford my cell phone. If I have a disease, there's no way I can find an antibiotic. So we can talk about history. I'm not saying that I'm pro an intervention, but I'm saying, like, the minds of Venezuelans right now are on a daily, you know, survival basis. And that's what the international community also needs to understand. Obviously, their life will be worse if there's an intervention for a while, and they're gonna get worse with the sanctions, and as if the uncertainty continues, it's gonna get worse. But people really just wanna end this period of misery that, you know, the majority of the Venezuelans have been submitted to, that have been, you know, living in. As you know, 9 out of 10 Venezuelans is in poverty. Many of the majority of the population has to skip many meals a day, and, you know, a salary, as you know, dissipates quickly because of hyperinflation, and you can barely afford, I think it is something like 2 eggs with a minimum wage. So,
And it's the idea too that even if nothing happens right now, the situation is going to get exponentially worse, because already you have close to 3,000 Venezuelans who have left in the last few years, and then the UN estimates that in I think 2018, 2019, it could be a whole other 2 million, so we'd be up to 5 million.
So we're talking about 10% of the population, and as we've said before, you know, the countries receiving the bulk of this, the countries receiving the bulk of these migrants are countries of lower and middle income per capita. I mean, I also follow Ecuador and Colombia and Peru for my work, and I'm just, you know, people are concerned about the fiscal deficits that Peru and Colombia have, and having to receive unhealthy, poor migrants into your countries, your health systems take a toll. So it's really this is without even mentioning the security risk and ties that, for example, the ELN in Colombia that has been actively recruiting Venezuelans in around the border. So there are really a lot of, from a financial point of view, pressures and to the neighboring countries who have taken the bulk of these migrants that have left Venezuelans.
Yeah, I believe Colombian President Iván Duque estimated that Colombia would spend over $1 billion receiving these Venezuelan migrants. And really, I think Colombia should really be commended for how much they have kept their doors open and gone to great lengths
to provide
these services.
Absolutely, and as a Venezuelan, we're grateful for that. And you know, we will not forget that they've been so receiving during these hard times, because we know that, you know, Colombia is not, you know, perfect on its, you know, its economy is not perfect. So it's been very generous to see.
Yeah, and I've seen a lot of Colombians express that sentiment that when Colombia was going through, you know, its violent years, that Venezuela received so many Colombians, and that this is returning the favor historically.
I mean, I grew up in Venezuela, so, you know, and the composition of the society that I was part of, I mean, there was people from Ecuador, people from Peru, people from Haiti, people from the Dominican Republic. It was really hard to go through your day without meeting or seeing, interacting with someone who wasn't from Venezuela. So it's nice to definitely, you know, hear that from Colombians.
Yeah, it really is a moment of regional solidarity.
Yes, it really is.
So let's talk right now about aid, because there's a big effort. The Maduro regime up until now denies there's a crisis, has rejected all international aid as people are starving, dying. So while the kind of political machinations work themselves out, what is happening on the international aid front?
Well, the government the team of interim President Guaido, many of them are in exile because they've been victims of political oppression before. So, for example, there is National Congressman, Assembly Member Jose Manuel Olivares, who has been a leader in doing a census that the government wouldn't do of the state of hospitals, the most important health needs and nutritional needs. So they have, in coordination with the U.S., Canada, and other donors, set up, a strategy to bring humanitarian aid to the borders. As we know, many of the people who are fleeing the country are doing it because they are in a dire health situation, like diabetes, HIV, or something where you really need a medication to survive. So the idea is to station some aid on the border. I mean, people have talked about an intervention through aid, but that's not what's going to happen. What they want is to pose the aid and really make it up to the militaries to say, no, I don't want it, even though behind them there's going to be an ocean of people wanting to have those nutritional supplements, mm-hmm. people to want to have access to those antibiotics, etc. So I think that, yes, I mean, some people have warned against the risk of putting aid this way, but at the same time, this has been one of the promises, one of the goals of the opposition since the humanitarian crisis started, is opening a humanitarian channel that can be led into the country. And this has also been one of the biggest flaws or criminal positions that the Maduro regime has taken, of saying, you know, we don't need to be beggars when people are dying of preventable diseases at an unprecedented rate. So,
and begging in the streets and digging through trash for their daily meals. So,
if you go right now in the Simón Bolívar Bridge in between Cúcuta and
in Colombia,
the Simón Bolívar Bridge that leads to Cúcuta, you find women selling their hair, and men and the boys, the Maduro regime. I mean, I think it was under Chávez or Maduro. They gave computers to every public school kid, and they were called canaimas, like the national park in the south. So now you find kids selling their computers and women selling their hair, because the need is so much of just accessing some money to eat, to survive, to be able to travel to another part of the region that where they may be able to find some jobs. So. Or it's going to be, I guess, interesting to see how, if you put aid there and then, you know, the military being a wall between an increasing number of people who need that aid, and then, you know,
all going to be literally in front of the soldiers' faces.
So, yes.
And I thought that was interesting that the Lima group, at their meeting, they made two, in their declaration that they released on Monday, they made two specific appeals to the military. And the first was to recognize Guaido as interim president and commander-in-chief. And then their second was to allow the international aid into Venezuela through the borders.
Exactly. And I mean, and again, that's telling. This is the region that is dealing with this crisis. This is the region that, these are the countries that are having to spend more money on their hospitals because they're receiving Venezuelans with diseases that had been priorly eradicated, like malaria, tuberculosis, etc., so measles. So, I want to reemphasize that, given that this is a humanitarian crisis, the region has, you know, a lot to say about, you know, what, how to deal with this crisis, and they have somehow, I mean, they have recently, they have come out in support of this humanitarian aid strategy that,
I do think it's interesting. I mean, it might seem like a small thing, or maybe not, but to literally just leave the aid on the border, it is a way too of really respecting the sovereignty of Venezuela's borders.
Yeah.
And saying, if this is going to come in, this needs to be, you know, the Venezuelan military has to allow it, the Venezuelan people, you know, will receive it.
Yeah, yeah. There's some concerns about, you know, the military stealing the aid and politicizing it, but I think that we are in certain ways past those times. I think that the state of the nation is in critical health, and, you know, I like to believe that there may be some scenarios that we haven't seen yet of you know, people coming together and really being able to take advantage of the humanitarian aid.
And I mean, we already know that the military heavily traffics the food that comes into the country,
yes.
But with medical supplies in particular, if you're a soldier, there's not much you can do with insulin if nobody in your family has diabetes. Not as many incentives, so.
And it's important to know, to highlight that this aid will not solve the country's problems. I mean, you talk to a humanitarian experts and they tell you that the biggest threat is a hyperinflation, that the biggest threats of why the country is in this place is price controls, is, the constant years of going after food producers. So this is not a country that where, you know, the threats are a natural disaster of a war, but actually has been, you know, mismanagement, corruption of the economy that have created this humanitarian crisis. So this aid may be important, but again, the country was not going to really turn around until there is a change in the economic policy. And that's not going to happen until the executive and, you know, until investors, until people perceive that there is a stability, a political stability, which, you know, at this point, Maduro cannot guarantee.
Yeah, there's the immediate work of kind of stemming the crisis.
Yes.
And then there's the long-term work of the rebuilding.
Yeah.
So, and on that long-term note, we should say, too, that this weekend, Canada pledged was $53 million to the recovery of Venezuela.
I think that's an incredible, I mean, amount, an incredible number. I think this is very generous of Canada. I think that, you know, that shows that these countries are really committed. They're not just committed to following some sort of ideology. No, they're really committed in helping Venezuela recover, and they're aware. These governments know firsthand because they've been following this crisis, and they're talking to the experts that the crisis is serious. This is not a media creation. This is real. I mean, there's a country where its people are facing a humanitarian emergency, and there's a region that is willing and able to help. So I think I am not shocked, but I'm a little bit pleasantly surprised by the generosity of the Canadian people and its government. And I do hope that it can be used as efficient as possible because it's very much needed.
Mm-hmm. All right. So I think that's about as much as we can cram into this one episode. I'm sure there will be more to come. So just in the next few days, though, I mean, on your radar, besides this oil running out in about a week, what else do you have on your radar?
Well, I think yesterday we saw one of the coup leaders with Chavez, February 4th, celebrated the 27th anniversary of when Hugo Chavez gave a coup in Venezuela to a constitutional elected president. And I thought it was telling that one of his lieutenants who led the coup with him was saying, we should come to the table, we should negotiate with dignity. So you're seeing, you're seeing, as I said, I don't know about the generals because that's really a dark box that many, very, very few people have access to. But you do see the Chavista architects, the revolutionary architects of this, I mean, the leaders of this revolution changing their mind and understanding that it's really going to be really hard to, you know, fight against this unity that there is between the international community, the opposition and the people that are very certain that the next step has to be a free and fair elections.
All right. And that is what we will be waiting and watching for. So, well, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you so much for having me on the podcast.
Thank you for listening. I'm your host, Karin Zissis. This podcast was produced by Luisa Lemmy. For more, visit our Venezuela Working Group at as-coa.org/VWG. The music in this podcast was recorded at America Society in New York City. For upcoming concerts, visit musicoftheamericas.org. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. If you did, please subscribe and write a review on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, Stitcher, or SoundCloud. Thank you.